and we'll have our panel back. A bunch of questions, bunch of good questions, hopefully lots of time for discussion. Hey, Van. And I'll have Dr. Ruderman and Dr. Ader come back to the podium here. So quite a number of questions about imaging. Let's start out with MRI. We keep talking about the SI. People have asked about adding the lumbar spine, adding other parts of the spine to that. What do you think? Eric, start with you.
I think if you're using the imaging to identify inflammatory changes that warrant treatment, that can help justify treatment in someone, particularly with non-radiographic disease, I don't think there's value in adding the lumbar spine, from my perspective, the SI joint. The changes are mostly in the SI joint. You're looking for bone marrow edema and inflammation, and there's an awful lot of noise in the spine when you start to look for those bone marrow edema changes and the signs of inflammation. So it sometimes can take you down the wrong path.
Leanne?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. So I think I agree that the majority of disease should start in the sacroiliac joints. In the absence of sacroiliac joint inflammation or past inflammation, it's unlikely that you're going to find the inflammation in the rest of the spine. The caveat is, I think that the jury's a little bit out for me in patients with psoriasis or psoriatic arthritis and inflammatory bowel disease. I think they can, you know, more follow the exception to the rule and actually have more spondylitis. And then so I usually start with sacroiliac joints. If I'm not seeing anything there and the patient's really localizing to somewhere in the spine, sometimes you get an alternate explanation. So I think the reason to do it the primary reason to do it is to identify disease, to diagnose the patient and then treat them. But sometimes you're coming up with an alternate diagnosis that allows you to say, okay, the patient doesn't have axial spondyloarthritis.
Leahy, you kind of alluded to, but the whole body MRI, what about, part of that would be you get the whole spine, but you seem to indicate it wasn't really something you're very excited about.
Yeah, I'm definitely not an expert on MRI, but I mean, potentially, my understanding that it's still, there are some issues still with the resolution when you do a whole body MRI, the quality is not as good as when you're doing MRI that is targeted to the sacroiliac joint and to the spine. So these are the sort of the technical issues. Maybe in future years, the quality will be high enough to allow us to view the entire spine and the enthesis. So,
a question came in, what about adding gadolinium? Any value to that?
I'll take that. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Leanne.
Not in adults. If you're looking for sacroiliitis, that's inflammatory. No, because we're not looking for synovitis. It's an osteitis. You add GAD when you're looking for synovitis of the hands or feet. If you're worried about infection, then it is helpful in the sacroiliac joints, and then not helpful in the spine for inflammatory. Again, osteitis, you shouldn't need it. In very young kids, again, you don't need it. It's not recommended. But they can have more of a synovitis in the sacroiliac joints, and so sometimes it can be helpful in a very small subpopulation. But in general, we should not be using GAD to identify sacroiliitis.
Okay, Eric, you agree?
I agree.
Okay. What about if you can't get an MR, any value of CAT scan imaging?
I mean, I think it's helpful for structural changes primarily. I mean, typically when we're doing the MR, we're looking for evidence of inflammatory change in the bone itself, which you don't see the same, but, a CT can be helpful if you're looking for structural changes to really identify if you've got the right diagnosis. Probably not something, I mean, it's not certainly in widespread use, but if you happen to have a pelvic CT and you see the SI joints, you can glean some information from it for sure.
Yeah, and actually, I should have, the whole part of the question, too, is with somebody you can't get an MR. They're too big. They can't get in the machine. Is a CT of any value there? Leanne?
Yeah, so I actually think, so not for inflammatory change, right? So we're not going to see bone marrow edema on a CT scan. But in particular, low radiation or low dose CT scan, which anyone that can do a CT scan should be able to turn down the dose. That actually in a woman is less radiation than an AP pelvis radiograph. And so for structural change, if you're looking for erosions in particular, it can be helpful. But if it's very early in the process, you may not see anything.
Okay. The question I really liked that came up, when is AI going to replace your local community radiologist in reading all of these images so we can have standardization? Let's get the whole panel here.
I think it's coming. Some of that data is pretty good. And, you know, radiologists are at the forefront of this. They've been doing this for lung nodules, for cancers, for, you know, mammograms for years. And I think it's going to be super helpful because then you're not relying on a radiologist who really, because, you know, typically we get these reports back and, you know, I don't know about your institutions, but often read by a radiologist is not a bone radiologist and not an MSK radiologist. And I look at what they report and I look at what I see on the imaging and they're not the same thing. So I actually think that AI is going to be very helpful there as time goes on.
Leahy, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with this. I think the gold standard is important, who is actually reading them. So developing an AI algorithm needs to be read by obviously expert readers and consider all the variants, psoriatic arthritis, men, women, all these other issues that, so the quality of the algorithm will depend on the data that will be entered into it and who actually consider what the gold standard is.
Okay, Leanne?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think it's coming. I just, you know, I think it's going to take time. If you ask MSK radiologists on the forefront of this, I think they don't believe that they will be replaced. but I agree that, especially if you look at the U.S., there are so many places that do not have an MSK radiologist or with deep expertise in imaging. And so we're going to have to use these techniques to at least be sensitive. And then I think you're going to need someone to weigh in on all these changes. So I think AI will flag things that may be abnormal, and then I think you'll still need a human person to confirm that what we're seeing is truly inflammatory.
Okay, let me turn over to Leahy. Do you screen for enthesitis with ultrasound in all your SPA patients, and which sites do you use if you're just screening?
So the short answer is that I don't screen. If the patient is completely asymptomatic, then I wouldn't do a scan. I use the ultrasound at the point of care. So in the clinic, I don't have time to do a very comprehensive assessment of enthesitis. So if, especially in early diagnostic phases, so for example, if a patient is coming with a psoriasis and they complain of some pain at the enthesis, then I would scan the tender enthesis, and if I do see signs that are very clear-cut enthesitis, then that could help me make a diagnosis, and I'm more certain about the diagnosis than if I would just press and get a pain response. So it's really guided by the tender sites. And what we are working on within GRAPPA is trying to come up with a more standardized tool and identify the more helpful sites. But I think at this point it would be mostly for research using in clinical trials and so on. So in clinic, it's really guided by findings.
So I think you'll get the data from Duet, but what about if you happen to do an ultrasound scan and you do find abnormalities, but it's not tender? Is that enthesitis?
You're asking difficult questions. There is a disconnect between the clinical enthesitis and the imaging enthesitis. So in many sites, when the data that we look at in Duet is quite interesting because there are sites that you see clear-cut findings of enthesitis, but they are not tender at all. For example, the triceps tendon is commonly involved, but we rarely find pain there. And then there are other sites that you have more pain, like the lateral epicondyle, the Achilles tendon, and they are also involved. So, I mean, what I think is important is to, ultrasound is really, it's not the only tool. So it helps us as clinicians to interpret the findings on the clinical exam. And we need to also think about the contextual factors. So is it someone who is older or younger? So I would interpret the findings a bit differently if I see a lot of bone formation and I don't see Doppler in someone who is in their 60s than if it's someone in their 20s. So I think we're learning more about how to interpret the imaging, and this will be hopefully coming up in the near future.
Okay. I think I know what you're going to answer, but just finish on the ultrasound. You know, there's not enough rheumatologists. Our young trainees love to do ultrasound, but it does take time. And as you said, you really need to focus on where the patient is reporting symptoms. But you saw last year there was from Denmark, they're working on an automatic ultrasound where it's basically it's machine learning, and you have a technician place the appendage, and then the ultrasound machine comes down and reads it, and it would actually seem to do pretty well. So is ultrasound going to be something that we're going to give up, like the cardiologist giving up echocardiograms? They don't do it themselves, and the obstetricians kind of gave up ultrasound because they have people who do it. Is that going to happen to us in rheumatology?
I do hope that it won't happen. I think ultrasound is a great tool, and more of the residents that are coming into rheumatology have some expertise, because it's really now at the point of care in internal medicine. So just, I believe that this really should be part of the curriculum. It's a long discussion, but I mean, it is very helpful, and as an extension of the physical exam, there are difficulties in terms of, we talked about AI in MRI. MRI is very, there is a protocol, and it's easier to, there is less noise. And with ultrasound, it's much harder to get these protocolized images. So there is a lot of noise there, and I don't think we are at the stage where we can develop algorithms, AI algorithms. And the limitation of technicians doing the exam is that they don't do the physical exam. The physical exam, they don't have the clinical knowledge to interpret the findings. So my personal view is that it should be in the hands of the rheumatologist.
Okay.
I have to chime in and agree. I mean, at our place, we have a couple rheumatologists who are really good at ultrasound. I am not. And it is much more helpful when we send patients to have an ultrasound by one of them than to radiology, because they can integrate it with the clinical story and the exam and the rest of it much better than Skippy, Phil's temporal arteritis ultrasonographer, can do, even with AI.
Okay. In the audience, Dr. Fung.
I wonder whether we know the cohort from the JIA, which have an ascites-initiated arthropathy. I mean, do we learn that from those cohort, how they are going to develop over time? I mean, we have any pediatric rheumatologists here?
So about progression from enthesitis-related arthritis to what happens in adults. Anyone, Leanne, want to jump on that?
I mean, you know, I think it's its own entity. There is some evidence that those kids can go on to develop axial involvement, you know, in the presence of B27, but I don't know that we have. I feel like I'm not expert enough to quote the most recent data on this. I see it as its own entity, though. And I think it's hard also because nowadays they're very aggressive treating kids with spondyloarthritis, including ERA, and so, you know, whether that then mitigates the transition to a different form of JIA or involvement of axial joints, the same treatments work. I don't know.
It seems like it's still a work in progress. I mean, they started out with JRA and then JIA, and now they're trying to develop, to break it up. And it's really more phenotypical breakups. And I don't know that we're yet at a place where we understand that that really defines kids with different diseases. And until we get more of that, I just don't know, because I don't know who, you know, which of the kids with an enthesitis-related arthritis are going to be more like an axial SpA than they have the kids who happen to have psoriasis, but there are kids who may get psoriasis. And I just don't think we're there yet. I think to me, it seems like it's still a work in progress, their nomenclature.
Okay. You mentioned for non-radiographic axial SpA that part of the rationale to have an MRI arm, but also a clinical arm, is that MRI is not universally available or to all patients or all doctors. There's several questions that wrote in. Kind of to summarize, is there a difference between non-radiographic axial SpA where they did an MRI and it was negative, but they made the diagnosis on clinical grounds, versus those who satisfied the MRI with inflammation?
I don't know if there's any good data that asks that specific question, like where do those people go? But there are a couple pieces to that. One is, what you see on MRI is not static. And there is some data that suggests that even in absence of a change in treatment, you know, what you might see on imaging now and repeating it 6 months later may be different. You know, and there's some data from placebo arms of clinical trials, for example, that can show you that. So that, you know, we sort of look at it and say, well, an MRI that shows bone marrow edema, that's a fixed issue. That's a done deal. But sometimes if it's negative, it may be positive at a later date. And in terms of whether the clinical scenario is different, I don't know where they end up going, but I do think it's important, because I think that it's with the MRI that you can establish that they truly have inflammatory disease that warrants some of the more aggressive and advanced therapies that we're using that may not be appropriate if you don't see that.
Okay, Leanne?
I think we need to be, so first of all, in this day and age, I don't think most of the world has access to MRI. Right. It may take longer. And so I think you need to be very careful even diagnosing patients in the presence of a negative MRI. And when I say negative, I don't just mean no bone marrow edema. I mean, no structural change either. So, you know, there are patients that we would define as a negative MRI, but they actually have erosions and subchondral fat. And they still have the disease. They just don't have disease activity on MRI at that moment. So I think you can still have a negative MRI. But a negative MRI being a normal MRI, you should think very carefully before you diagnose a patient with axial spondyloarthritis, including non-radiographic disease. Non-radiographic doesn't mean no imaging. It means no change enough on x-ray to classify the patient as non-radiographic. That's different than saying not imaging.
Right.
Several questions on repeat MRI. When would you do it? Why would you do it? And a specific question, because you raised this, Leanne, is if before you taper biologics, would you want repeat MRI?
Yeah, the only time I repeat MRI is in the presence of, and this is in the ACR guidelines, the presence of uncertain disease activity in a patient on a biologic. So when I have a patient on a biologic and they're reporting new or increased disease activity and the CRP is normal, then I like the imaging to help me feel better about the fact that actually there's another driver of the symptomatic disease activity that's not active inflammation. I don't, even though that evidence suggests that having no bone marrow edema predicts being able to sustain drug-free remission, I don't do it before tapering. And you know, tapering for me doesn't mean stopping. It just means reducing the dose in a shared decision.
Okay. Leahy or Eric?
No, I think that makes sense. It's particularly, you know, not as a routine, but in someone who doesn't appear to be responding to your therapy, if you're thinking about switching to another biologic, I think it'd be helpful. Now, the alternative is if you're suspicious that it isn't inflammatory, you might get the same mileage out of a trial of duloxetine instead of an MRI to see if they respond to that. If you think that their ongoing pain is not truly inflammatory pain, I've done that before too.
Okay. Jack?
So I was thinking about immobilization during Leahy's lecture about its role in enthesitis management. And then Leanne asked or suggested thinking outside the box when you don't know what else to do. And when I was a resident, I went and did a rotation at the University of Pittsburgh with Rodnan and Metzger. And doing rounds with Metzger, they had an inpatient rheumatology unit. They had two horrific spondylitis patients that were admitted for bed rest. And SED rates went from 88 to 22. You know, pain went from, you know, 11 out of 10 to, you know, to 3 or 4. And they left the hospital on what they could use at the time, which was NSAIDs. This is a question for both Leahy and for Leanne. Let's start with Leanne. Is there a role today where you would actually advise bed rest and have an expectation for it?
No. I mean, I think exercise is anti-inflammatory, right? But I think that there is this Goldilocks phenomenon of physical activity where too much is not good either and too little is not good. But I think bed rest is never going to be a good, I don't think it's going to be a good idea, besides for the bone loss that will happen from being rested for an extensive period of time. So, I don't mean to be so black and white about it, and maybe Eric and Leahy have a different opinion, but no, I would not put people to bed anymore.
Now, they used to admit RA patients for weeks at a time, and do you do that anymore? No. Would you ever consider doing that anymore? Or bringing a psoriasis patient in for Geckerman treatment and wraps for 2 weeks? I mean, we've moved on.
Well, I think the only caveat, maybe I do inquire about excessive physical activity. So sometimes you have marathon runners or people that do it as a hobby, and I would advise take some rest and I'll treat it, and I would... you know, because I've seen that there are flares related to excessive activity. So in this situation, you may say, okay, we treat it, but if it comes back, please consider modifying, you know, this. But bed rest, I think, is a bit extreme.
So Leahy, you brought this up in your lecture, but there's still a number of questions. Fibro? points and antithesial points, the maps overlap. Any tips on telling the difference? I guess one is if the patient says "ow" before you touch them, which I think is a good indicator of fibro. But you're the expert. Any tips?
Use ultrasound.
Do the ultrasound.
I think it's honestly it's impossible to make a diagnosis. Patients with, we talked about the sex and gender issues, and women tend to be or maybe more tender, and there is the more diffuse pain, but it doesn't mean that they don't have active enthesitis. And I think we are going to, we talked about biases as well, and I think it's really important to still investigate, even if you think fibromyalgia is a comorbidity, they can have both. So use imaging.
Okay. In the lectures, it comes across that the CRP really has an important role in axial SpA. What about people who have elevated CRP and you don't think it's related? Obesity or other reasons to have an elevated CRP? What do you do? How do you approach those instances? Actually, that was the most upvoted question.
Hmm. Well, you know, from my perspective, the CRP is one data point. And so if you've got a history that sounds like this is active inflammatory pain and active axial disease and a CRP, I think you use that as further evidence that there's active disease that would potentially respond to aggressive therapy. I don't know if you have a patient who doesn't have those symptoms and has an elevated CRP, but you know they have AxSpA, I wouldn't treat just the CRP alone. It's a data point along with the rest of your clinical evaluation, at least to me.
Leigh? Sorry.
Nope, Leigh, go ahead.
I mean, I agree totally that it's a data point. I always say to patients, we treat patients, not their numbers.
Right.
So it adds to the burden of evidence. I also tend to use a cutoff of, if I'm thinking BMI is driving it, CRP for me, more than 10 is less likely to be just BMI.
Right.
Okay, Leigh, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree, and I think it's also, it changes the ability of CRP to be a good marker may change within individuals. So you kind of see over time if they respond, there is a correlation between their clinical response and CRP. If it comes down, then within that individual patient, it might be a useful marker. In other people, it doesn't change much, and then you may say, okay, this is coming from something else.
Okay. We know that non-steroidal use and a number of other things, even room temperature, can affect ultrasound findings. Can that affect MR? Do you tailor your patients to stop non-steroidals before you send them for an MR? Eric?
I don't know, but I don't think so. I've not ever seen anything about that. I mean, they certainly aren't effective enough to change what you see on imaging. You know, when you use a biologic and you have an MRI beforehand and MRI afterwards, the bone marrow edema melts away. We don't see that with an NSAID, so I would think they don't have enough of an impact to worry about it.
And related to that, before another question, how often do non-steroidals put axial SpA patients in clinical remission?
Well, let me answer the first one first. So I think, you know, there was that UK study that came out in the last year suggesting that NSAIDs did decrease bone marrow edema. It was an uncontrolled study. Similar to Eric, don't feel like there is enough burden, and I certainly wouldn't stop either someone's treatment or prevent them from starting an NSAID before imaging them. I think it's very reasonable to empirically treat people with NSAIDs even while you're doing the workup. And I don't think it's going to make that much of a difference to completely remove bone marrow edema if that's what's really driving the symptoms. Your second question was, will it put you into remission? I think I have a number of patients that are just on NSAIDs and are in remission. So I do believe that they can be very effective as monotherapy. For me, it's probably 30% of my patients are on NSAIDs monotherapy, full dose. Now, I think there are a portion of patients that then go into remission and then go to on-demand use. They sort of take it with symptoms, and that keeps them. But so how do you define remission? Complete, no asymptomatic, no serologic inflammation, disease activity that's low. Many patients require continuous use of NSAIDs to maintain that remission, though.
Okay. Eric, Leigh?
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason that all the iterations of the guidelines over the years have always left NSAIDs in as first-line therapy, because in a percentage of patients they can work. And unlike RA, where you worry that, you know, if they're feeling better with NSAIDs, you're not controlling disease progression, here I don't think, I mean, our goal primarily is symptom and functional resolution, much more so than disease progression. And so if you get that with an NSAID, you're fine and do not have to move on to a biologic until, you know, 10 or 15 years down the road when their creatinine starts to climb, which I've run into several times, and that becomes the trigger to switch them over to a biologic therapy.
Okay. Maybe on the other extreme, I don't think this happens a lot clinically, but the question for Leahy, biologics for enthesitis only, I guess, meaning not there's no peripheral arthritis and axial or skin psoriasis, would you use biologics for enthesitis?
Yeah, I think it's a really important question that comes up, because, you know, we've shown that enthesitis, when it's proven, again, I emphasize proven, imaging proven enthesitis, is a risk factor for development of joint damage. It is a marker of severity. And we tend to focus on synovitis, and if we don't see synovitis, then we say, okay, that's only just some pain in the tendon. I think we have to be a bit more aggressive in treatment, and the issue, at least in Canada, is how do we get access? Because at least for us, we need to show 5 swollen joints, and the patient wouldn't be eligible for a biologic only based on enthesitis. So that's a limitation. But I personally think, especially given the lack of good data to show efficacy for non-biologics, that we have to think about it as definitely as an indication to treat patients if it's this the predominant manifestation of disease.
Okay, and then last question we'll get to Leanne. Is the ACR coming out with updated guidelines for AxSpA?
Yeah, so we're actually right now getting started. I think, though, the whole movement of the ACR guidelines is moving to more of a living process where they'll get updated all the time as new therapies become available and new evidence is generated. But yes, we are actually currently working towards that next stage.
Yeah.
I suspect it'll be at least a year.
Great. Well, thank you very much to all our panelists. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this reprise session from RoomNow Live 2024. This session and these recordings were sponsored by AbbVie, UCB, and Amgen. Be sure to register for RoomNow Live 2025 when you can have full access to all the videos, all the recordings, all the downloads, and all the board questions that come out of RoomNow Live 2025.